この患者にもがかぬしんしん。
Hello, listeners. I'm Martin Kessler, and you're listening to FlixWise Canada. I'm joined once again by Spencer Seams. Hello, Spencer.
Hello, Martin.
Good to have you back. And last time you were on the show, you still had the High and Low podcast going on. But now that's come to an end, and you have a new endeavor. I was wondering if you'd like to say one or two things about it, or see if that for the end.
I can do both. The first season me and Joel did was on Kurosawa. Basically, an excuse for us to go through Kurosawa movies, and we decided to do a second season, and we switched to Spike Lee, because we thought it'd be interesting to do a Spike Lee movie versus what won Best Picture that year. The right. movie released that year. The Oscars math make it complicated, but yeah, so we're doing that with Spike Lee. We're going to do some special episodes on stuff like Daughters of the Dust. Will be one, as of this recording, pretty recent. And then we have a special episode on Armin Bette films with hopeful guest Ntume Gant.
I'll be looking forward to listening. So last year we talked a little bit about the film Darat by him. Here, I'm going to try to fix the pronunciation because I found out that last time I was doing it a little bit off. I was close, but it's Mahamat Salah Harun. It's better than last time, right?
Yeah.
Maybe a little. anyway, so on that episode, we talked a little bit about some of his other films you kind of recommended to me. And I guess this is the follow-up. We're going to be talking about a pair of his films that came out after Darat. Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, which is a comedy film that's about a family from Mali living in France. The father, Malik, gets dumped. The wife goes off with another guy, and it's sort of about him trying to manage his family in France when all he wants to do is go back home.
Yeah.
I think he says right at the beginning, if I won the lottery, I'd go right back home.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of, I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but Xala.
Oh, Xala. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Is it the height of the lead actor?
That and just kind of the general vibe a little bit. I feel like he took some inspiration from that.
I could see that. I just think of like the wife towering over him at the beginning of Xala when he's like talking about getting another wife.
Doesn't every wife tower over him in that?
Every wife towers over him. I mean, like, I say this as a guy who's not that tall. Like, in Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, it's just kind of funny how short he is sometimes. Like, getting outraged and, like, yelling, and he's kind of a tiny guy. Like, I think, you know, if it wasn't Marius Yellowlow, who's also in the other film we're going to be talking about, you know, if you had a different actor, like, I mean, say you got Yusuf Jaro.
It wouldn't really work.
No, like, you wouldn't be laughing at him, I don't think.
Yeah, it'd be more sad with Marius. Yeah. It's definitely funnier.
Right. And one thing I like about Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter is it's a comedy, but it's shot and the direction treats it as if it's a drama. It's just so happens that what's happening on screen and what's coming from these character interactions is funny. I mean, there's a couple, like, you know, jokey little set pieces. Like, there's a scene where he sneaks into the hospital with bandages all over his face in a wheelchair, yeah. And the wife just, like, kind of shoves him out, and that's a very, like, a comedy moment. But a lot of the humor just sort of comes from the characters, and it kind of made me think of, like maybe Mike Lee, some of his lighter-hearted films. But, like, you know, there's definitely a like an almost documentary like feel for Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter at some points, with a handheld camera and these sort of naturalistic performances. Nobody's trying to be funny, but then you get these reactions which are very funny.
Yeah, like the Coen brothers type of comedy where sometimes it's just the interactions and like the character moments happen to be funny, but it's not necessarily like a jokey joke.
Right. One moment that kind of stuck out is in Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, when Malik finds out that his son Danny is gay, or had sex with the guy for the first time, like the scream or yelp that he does, it's like a ah! It's so, and then like half an hour later into the film, he's just like opening the door or something like that, and his son's there. He was watching after the kids, and he goes to like shake his hand, and he just goes, ah, again. Like, I don't know why. You get what's happening with the character, but it's just such a like unexpected reaction, or like a funny kind of reaction that it makes it funny. But, and the other film we're going to be talking about, totally like you can't get more different, is Screaming Man.
Yes,
The
which
2010 film, which it's
what is the big follow-up to Darat? Because Sex,
yeah,
Okra, and Salted Butter, I believe, was a TV movie in
right. And
France.
like he sort of mentioned how he'll go into a film in France and then go into a film in Chad, or how it kind of goes back and forth like that. And it sort of feels like, maybe almost like a palate cleanser before it can go back and kind of do the same thing again, because A Screaming Man feels like a really strong continuation of the themes that he started exploring in Darat. And there's like some carryover, or like some little similarities I noticed with the Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, that like it's still obviously her own film, but it's just, you feel like, okay, like this is the serious one that's dealing with like specifically Chadian and issues, and it's kind of going back to that. And it's almost like you maybe need to do a little comedy film in between before you can go back and revisit that, because The Screaming Man is pretty heavy, very, very heavy.
In between his like Chad films, he'll do like go to France, do like just to do like that TV movie, or he'll like do like a documentary. Like he'll just do, like in between his African films, kind of do something notably different, and then kind of go back to Chad and be like, okay, this is a more serious movie. Although he kind of broke that trend, because in between The Screaming Man and Gris Gris, which
Right, and
it's
now
a
the season in France is kind of the
yeah, he went back.
latest.
But Gris Gris, I don't like very much. It's kind of his least good one. It's not bad. It's just not as good as a Screaming Man or the stuff around it. But there's no, like nothing he did really in between. Like he did two and Chad back to back. But Gris Gris is, I don't know. It's I just have mixed feelings on it.
I haven't seen that yet, but I don't know. I'll let you know as soon as I do, or maybe we'll even talk about it in a follow-up at some point.
Maybe.
But like A Screaming Man, I guess I should give a quick little outline. It's about a man named Adam, who's played by Yusuf Diaw, who's the lead in, or not exactly the lead, like the co-lead in Darat. But here he's playing a pretty different character.
Yeah, he actually
He's
speaks this
yeah,
time.
he actually has a voice in this, and he's like an ex swimming champion. He mentions that he was like the top Central African swimmer in 1965, which like happens to be right when the civil war in Chad starts. He's sort of nostalgic about that time. And
I never made that connection until just now.
when the film starts, he's working at a hotel that's just been privatized, and he's kind of the pool manager. And then he's demoted to a gatekeeper, and his son, who's played by the same actor who plays Danny in Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, his son Abdel gets his job, and he sort of resents him for that. And he ends up basically sending his son off to war. Just not exactly to get back at him, but it's like he feels sort of threatened by his son, and then pretty soon regrets it. So that's kind of the premise of A Screaming Man.
And the title comes from a poem that I tried to look, try to find, but I'd have to buy a whole book. So,
Oh yeah,
yeah.
that's what was the poem? Do you know what language it was written in?
I don't remember, but I would think French, given that it's Harut. I'm not gonna say his name because I know I'll say it wrong.
I'm trying. I try.
Yeah, like I love African films, but like I don't like saying the names of actors or directors out loud because I feel stupid.
I know, I like just continually embarrass myself, right? But I'd be curious to read the poem because, like, how I took the title just in watching the film, it's like there's no point in the film where he's screaming at the heavens. So you just sort of feel like he's screaming on the inside all the time. It's this like quiet internalization. And you have the scene where he's been demoted to the gatekeeper. And I mean, I kind of pitched the film as being a little bit humorless to listeners, but not exactly. There's like some slapstick actually when he's kind of going back and forth trying to open the doors for all these cars, and it's sort of just like a humiliating job for him.
Yeah, I read a review that compared it to like a Jacques Tati type bit. Thanks.
I mean, that moment is, yeah,
Yeah, but instead
after
of
not, but.
yeah, but instead of that moment, like for Jacques Tati, it'd surely be funny. In this, it's like taking the like what would be funny to something demeaning and pretty sad to watch.
Yeah, like because the character, he has so much pride that just seeing him put in this situation that he feels is humiliating and it kind of hurts his pride. Like you have that great close up where the camera just gets closer and tighter on his face, and I thought like, you look at his eyes and it's like he's just screaming on the inside, and it's sort of about, in part, him kind of internalizing all this frustration and anger, and he kind of takes it out in a way that is ultimately harmful and unhealthy on his own family, on his own son.
But Perun always talks about all his films are political,
Yes.
and like a common theme with his films is that like the politics of something will like a political situation will affect a common person. Usually, I think also an African, it's a common African in ways that they have to make a decision, and that decision is never a easy decision to make.
Right. I mean, that's something that he explored a lot in Darat, and it's like trying to find the right decision. It's like usually sort of messy and not quite one side or the other. Like, I thought it was interesting how the Civil War, the film, feels really in the background for the first half. Like it's on the TV screens, and like you have guys kind of hitting him up, like, "Oh, you should donate your money to the front," or sort of. It feels really far away. You kind of hear about it, and then as soon as he actually sends his son out to fight against his will, like guys come and drag his son away, that's when it starts becoming real for him. And that's like, when you have rebels attacking the city and people are starting to leave, and like, that tape that the son sends back to his girlfriend, like it starts making the war something personal that affects him directly, and that's sort of when he starts to think about it differently.
There's this weird sense of like almost comfort of knowing a civil war is happening because Chad has been an unstable country for a long time, basically since it was independent. And like there's a sense of like he is just Adam is just used to it. He is this, it's like yeah, civil war, I know, but my job's more important.
Right. Yeah, like it's, when it doesn't affect you personally, like it's sort of easy for people to kind of compartmentalize something and not think about it or not treat it like a serious issue. I think that's part of it in the film.
And
And
everyone calls him champ or a champion the whole
the
time.
chump, yeah. And like even like there's one part where he gets caught at night after curfew when it's dark and he's on his motorbike, and like the only reason he really kind of gets out of trouble is because he's recognized as being the champ. Like, oh no, it's the champ. Like, don't you recognize him? Like, let him go through, So it gives him some kind of cachet. He's not like exactly a celebrity, but he's kind of,
He's a local
you get the,
hero.
yeah, he's a local hero. And
Yeah, my dad grew up in a small town of Virginia, and someone who I think he's like 5 or 6 years younger than him played in the NBA for like 15 years and moved back there recently. And like, there's kind of a similar situation of like, it Bimbo Coles is just like the local hero everyone remembers, and it's like he kind of has a certain cachet in that small
yeah.
town just simply because like he's like he made it.
Right, it's like the "I'll buy you a beer" cachet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, like even at the hotel when people start losing their jobs, like his best friend David, who's played by Marius Yololo from Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter. Like, he's sort of saying, well, I didn't really stand a chance of keeping my job, but like, you're the champ and you're gonna fight them. And like, and Adam doesn't quite tell him that, like, I'm not still watching the pool. It's like he's worried his friend's heart doesn't quite, like, he has heart trouble, David, so like, he doesn't quite want to crush him too much by being like, oh yeah, I lost my job too, basically.
Yeah, I like David a lot. He's like one of the sources of lightness in the movie. 'Cause I think that's the moment you're talking about where he's like says something like, "Oh, when I'm in love, I add too much salt to my food."
Yes. Yeah, like he sort of cheers him up, and like when he kind of disappears from the film about a third of the way in, and like he comes back for one scene later on, but like you can sort of feel the tone getting increasingly serious. Like gradually you can kind of feel Haroon sucking the light out of the story, and it becomes more somber as it goes on. You know, like there's scenes early on which are just sort of light, pleasant scenes, yeah.
Yeah, one of the first scenes you get is Adam with his wife, and they're watching the news, and there's
Oh,
this
and they're
her,
eating the melon.
yeah, eating
Yeah.
watermelon, just not caring in the world, and like they like kiss with watermelon, and it's just this romantic moment, and then
I wish more films just had like romantic moments between like middle-aged married couples. Like you hardly ever see that in films.
yeah, you point out I don't think I've seen that very often. But and like it's interrupted by the neighbor, who's it's a
Yeah.
recurring thing. A neighbor comes by and asking for something, and a wife, what's her name? Not Marion, it's something like that.
Is it Marion, maybe?
So yeah, I think that's it. And she just calls her, like, "Why don't you buy more stuff when you're
Or
at the
no, is
market?"
Miriam the... I think I got mixed up. Miriam's the character from Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The lady on the same floor that keeps hitting on Malik.
Yes.
She's like, oh, can you come in and take a look at my foot and massage it? And he's kind of like going along with it, like, oh yeah, I used to be a healer. That's Miriam, but I'm sorry, I forget the...
Mario? Marum? Something like that.
I'd have to go to the IMDb list and kind of try to figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I've been wrong too.
I'm not sure if she's an actress, because I know Haroon likes to use non-actors in
Yeah.
smaller roles, so it feels more authentic. And I'm pretty sure the wife and Eshmoon Man was just someone who lived nearby.
Okay. She's good in the film. I mean, like, it's a smaller role. Like, she doesn't factor into the plot as much as, the son does, but she has such a good presence in the film.
Yeah. Oh, I when I was taking out my notes and like thinking about like how the movies are connected and not connected, one thing that really stuck out was that the son, like he plays the oldest, like the older son in Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter also, and in both movies he is
Yeah.
in a relationship with a woman who is pregnant.
Yeah, like the woman who's pregnant comes to live in the
Yeah.
family. Like it's sort of an interesting thing that happens in both stories where you have this young pregnant woman coming to live with, the main character's kind of like, oh, what's she doing in my place? And eventually she kind of, finds a home in there. And in both stories, like I think they're, these young pregnant women, they're
Yeah,
from other
right.
countries. I think in A Screaming Man, she's from Mali,
Yeah, and another one,
and
she's from Ivory Coast, I think.
yeah, she's from the Ivory Coast. And like you sort of get a sense, like when they're talking about, their family, like, do they don't really have a place to stay, like do they not have somewhere to go? And it felt a little bit just like exploring sort of broken families and also how new families can kind of form out of that.
Yeah. I kind of like a low key shopkeepers.
Yeah. And like in Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, the son, like, he's even though he's gay, he sort of brings her into their home just to, like, I guess he kind of takes pity on her. And then after he decides
Yeah,
that, oh, like, we can fake a relationship because, like, my dad will think I'm straight, and then, like, your baby will have a father.
yeah.
And I mean, the final line in the movie, it's her telling him like, "Oh yeah, the father's white," and he kind of does the same like ah thing that his dad does. But
There's a whole past intergenerations thing with like what Koma playing like a like the representation of the younger generation and past generations, except in one he dies, and in the other he has to live with the fact that he's raising a half-white child.
Right. I mean, and also, like, I think in Sex, Ochre, and Salted Butter, he mentions that Malik's not his biological father. He married his mother when she was pregnant with another man, like, with him. So you sort of get the feeling that, like, hey, this is okay because, like, my father actually did this, and that is passed down, like, from one generation to another as well within the film.
Yeah, and that whole like the fake marriage thing is very, it's very retro and like old fashioned, but it doesn't feel like the way it treats homosexuality is, it's not regressive or anything. It's just like it could have been handled a lot worse, but just the way it's handled with the character and how his family takes it is very is like I was surprised just how well it's handled.
Yeah, I mean, the film definitely has a different point of view than Malik does. Like, you're meant to sort of look at it ironically when he's saying his son dishonored him and going on all that. Like, it's clearly in the wrong, and you're supposed to look at him as a flawed character, and it's kind of about him. He never quite gets over his prejudice or his. Like, it's not like the film ends with him being like, "Well, I accept you for who you really are, son." But it's sort of like him saying, "Like, you're my son. I love you. I'm trying. Like, I love you all. I just don't know how to show it. I'm getting old." Like, it's more like that kind of a sentiment than, he's completely changed as a person. Which, in some ways, like, I think that's probably more realistic in a lot of cases. Like, he's kind of set in his ways. He's not really going to change that much, but, like,
That's
at
a
the end of the
common
day, he
thing.
still loves his son no matter what.
Yeah, that's a common theme with fathers in Harun movies. They are set in their ways, or father-like figures, like in Durrant. He's like Nasrallah, like lives in the past because he's haunted by what he did. And Screen Man Adam, he lives in the past. He wants it to be, he wants to be the champion forever. And then Malik, wants to go back to Africa because he hates living in France. And so there's this whole theme of like father figures, needing to learn, like, you have to move on. And usually that's in the form of a son.
I mean, like, in A Screaming Man, it feels so at the center of that story, the lack of the father stepping aside to make room for his son, and the kind of being threatened by him is ultimately like what leads to his son's death by the end of the film. And it's a very regretful, sad ending, but it's like, I don't know, it's like the Saturn eating his children or something like that. Like, this idea that, like, nobody can usurp me. I have to, like, put down the younger generation no matter what. And like, the idea that the older generation tries to stay on top and will actually undercut the success of the next generation. It's sort of this, tragic human quality that you sometimes see. But I don't, it made me think a little bit of that, like, on a larger scale. But it's just like a specific character motivation. It's interesting, this idea that, like, throughout the film you see him looking at himself in the mirror trying to, like, suck in his gut and like doing sit-ups at night. Like, he just wants to be, the champ forever. He doesn't want to let go of that, and he doesn't want to let go of the past.
Even though he's like a 6-year-old man, he's still very vain.
Like, he gets so resentful when he finds out that his son's taking over as the pool manager, but then, like, you see the son doing, like, exercises with all the ladies in the pool, and they're clearly, like, crushing on him. And, like, it's like, of course they want to be with this, like, young in shape guy, not, somebody who's kind of 60 and daydreaming about better days. But I, like, it's I don't know, like, it's a really great character piece while also having those bigger political connections. Like,
yeah, and one of the big things about that, I didn't really realize the first few times. I think it's like the fourth time I've seen it. It's the Haru I watched the most. Even though it's like objectively very tragic, I find it very watchable at the same time. But something I didn't really notice the first few times was the presence of the Chinese, because the whole...
Yes.
I'm not sure how many listeners would know the current Africa politics situation, but like financially. But China has invested a lot of money into Africa since like maybe 2009, 2008-ish time.
Yeah, and basically it's... I mean, it's like a form of colonialism almost, where you
see... Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, it's Chinese expansionism, and they do it through commerce, and they do it through, you know, sometimes corrupt officials to get a foothold in countries, and it, like, have you seen the documentary Empire of Dust?
No.
It's, I mean, it's a controversial documentary, because people kind of take different things from it, depending who you ask, but it's showing... the Chinese presence in former Belgian Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo. And it's just sort of interesting to see, or, you know, even tragic to see in some cases, like the kind of return to exploitation and a sort of colonial mindset, just with a new country taking advantage. Like it's a little bit like that, or, you know, in the sort of misunderstandings you get... it's also like kind of a tragic comedy documentary, where you have just the cultural differences between this Chinese manager and these African workers. So,
yeah, and like the whole more like this is we're getting more into like the African economic thing, but like it was supposed to help, you know, like it was purported like this will help everyone, but it helped the government and helped people who are rich. But if you weren't in the government or rich, you would say exactly the same. So the whole, like, it did boost the economy, but it boosted the economy for people who already had a foothold in the economy. So,
even in the film, I mean, the one Chinese character, Miss Wang, like, she's not portrayed as being like bad or really evil or anything. But like, look at the way she talks to. The way she talks to Adam when like he shows up to work when nobody else does, like when the war's starting to get close to the city, you know, and it's totally like you're the good one who's showing up, and like almost putting on that pressure so that, you know, later on when like the civil war's heating up basically right outside the doors of the city, and the wife's like, oh, you know, we have to get going, and Adam's like, what about the pool? Like, who's going to wash the pool? And she has to really like, no, this is life or death. Like, never mind the pool. Like, you know, again, it made me think of this like colonial kind of attachment, where you have this, you know, sort of symbolic thing, the pool, that, you know, you sort of get the feeling like he would even die at one point to do his job and watch the pool. Like, he's so glad when he has the job back after he's got his son taken away. I don't know. It's, like that aspect of it, it's just a tiny, tiny part of the movie, but it's interesting to see how it's worked in and how it's just sort of part of the background texture of it.
Yeah, and like it, the whole like thematic thing of all these different forces, you know, coming down on Adam, it's foreshadowed in the very beginning, because in the opening credits you get Yusuf Jaro. You see his name come up on a black screen, and then you see Koma's name show up. You see the Chinese actress, I can't remember her name, show up around his name in smaller letters. So, like, immediately, like, it's saying up, like, you know, like
they're surrounding him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even, like, the very opening of the film, when the title shows up, like, it's him and his son holding their breath underwater. And it's like, who can... You know, they're in competition right from the beginning.
Yeah, but like, it foreshadows their whole relationship.
And then it mirrors the ending, which is really haunting, where he, like, the son, when he's dying, just says he wants to swim in the river, and Adam brings him dying and sort of lays him down in the river. Or he's dead already, but he lays him in the water and he sort of drifts away. Like it's kind of a mirror of that opening shot, and you're just seeing them in a completely different place.
Yeah, and there's a whole, the body drifts away, and that's and it's how they drifted apart, and it's all literally all Adam's fault. But then again, like he was forced into a situation of, you get arrested for not paying, the military and the government, contribution money, or you donate your child. So he is stuck in a horrible situation of one or the other.
Well, I think like he doesn't realize until after that he even necessarily had a choice. Like I think he lets his own feelings of being threatened by his son kind of make him make a bad decision, and then there's no taking it back. Like it's that kind of a thing, and you sort of feel his regret that in that ending, like that long drive, there's a bunch of long takes of him on his motorcycle, and he puts on the swimming goggles, to keep the dust out of his eyes while he's on the motorbike, and it just gives you this long stretch where you kind of feel how far out he's driving on the motorbike and how the day kind of turns into night. Just to let it sink in, I think like how much he regrets this decision and like how desperate he is to try to bring his son home. I think one of the impressive things about the editing in the film is it knows when to let certain moments linger and when to let you actually contemplate what you're seeing on screen and give you a little bit of space to sort of process things and to kind of feel more, feel the impact when certain decisive moments happen. I mean, like also comedically, I mean, again, there's like a few funny moments. I was thinking about the editing, like how sharp and precise it is. Like after David gets replaced, like the chef who kind of comes in to replace him, who chases away the dog that David used to give stuff to, give like leftovers to. When he sits on that bench and it breaks, and it, like the comic timing is, it like it's so perfect the way it edits. I was wondering if that bench just like broke by accident and they caught it on film or what, like, or if it was planned. Like I guess it must have been planned, but it's just like such a, you have that image where Adam's like sitting on the bench by himself and kind of thinking, and then this guy sort of breaks his solitude and kind of breaks his bench on top of that. But
Well, the editor is Marie Helene Ardozzo. She was she's I think she's edited every Haroon movie except for Bye Bye Africa and A Season in France.
How's the editing in the Season of France? How does it compare to it, or is it like noticeable a Season of France?
It's similar enough that I didn't immediately pick up on it, but A Season in France does feel a little different compared to his other films.
I'm looking now. She edited 2 Days, One Night, the Dardenne Brothers film. That's interesting. I'm gonna have to watch it again with that in mind.
Oh, and the music, Screen Man Hackley has a score that plays a couple times, which it's very strategic in when and where the score comes in. Where, like, in Darat, I believe there is no soundtrack at all. It's only the end credits, and this one is almost completely silent, except for a couple key moments. And Wassis Diop, who was the brother of Djibril Diop Mbete, did the music again.
One scene that's really great is when the pregnant girlfriend listens to the tape of the son sort of talking about how much it sucks being on the front and being in the war. Abdel's talking about how miserable it is and you've seen people die. And then when she starts crying and singing at the same time, you get this really powerful moment. It's music in the world of the film. Like it's not non-diegetic sound, but it's just done in a way that I really felt affected by. Like I don't, have you seen a film called Bamako by
Oh, I know what you're talking about. No.
Abderrahmane Sissako? Like
Yeah,
it's
that's I think that is on Netflix DVD. And there's a pretty cheap DVD on Amazon of it.
Okay, it's really good. There's like a scene where the girl's singing and crying, and it's like sort of similar. And the actress from that's actually in Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, so like I'm guessing there might be a reference to it. Or
Oh, is she the pregnant girlfriend in Sex Opera? I was talking about Haroon's films that has that like really surprised me the first time I saw Durrant was and like in like Screaming Man does it and Sex Okra and Salt and Butter does it. Like where in North America you see movies people as casually being Christian and it's just accepted, and in his movies you see people casually being Muslim. And it's just like I'm not used to seeing that in movies still. I've seen like, a few a number of African films, it still is kind of like, oh, it's just refreshing to see someone casually being, this is their religion.
I mean, like, there's like films where like it's really like the central subject is Islam and kind of dealing with that, but like how it's sort of in the background and it's just part of the culture. Like there's that scene in A Screaming Man when he's talking, I think it's with David. Like he asks him if he believes in God, and David says like, I believe in God, but I'm losing faith in him. And it's this sort of haunting answer, but it feels like a conversation you could have, in a different film with with Christians or with some other religion. It's just like that feeling of like, yeah, I believe in God, but like things are getting bad and I don't necessarily trust that God's gonna save us sort of thing. It just made me think of that. Like I mean, Durrant has it, but
It's a little more prominent in that with like him with the Nasrallah trying to redeem himself, and Atim is kind of in that phase of like starting to question religion.
I mean, that's a little bit more prominent there. Here it just sort of feels like it's part of part of the texture of the story where it's set in. And then in Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, again, it's a comedy, so it sort of deals with it a little bit differently, and it's also dealing with like the few times when Islam comes up, it's like in relation to French people kind of asking questions. Like I think it's when the auntie comes, the sister. I wasn't sure if she was Malik's sister or sister-in-law because it seemed like maybe she was closer with the wife, like when she comes to kind of try to straighten things out between them.
Yeah, I think she's a sister-in-law to Malik, but it's
I
never
thought
exactly
so.
clear. But they call her Mama, so but that's like a term of endearment, and that made it even more confusing.
It like a little confusing there, but like when she goes to meet the wife's new boyfriend, and I think he asks like, "Oh, like aren't you Muslim?" When she's like pouring wine, she's like, "I'm moderate." Like, don't even, like that's the only time it really comes up. It's like sort of in relation to,
And one
somebody
of
asking a
the
question or.
and one of the village elders visit
Oh, I love the elders. I bet you the
Vishamali.
second that like Wes Anderson sees this film, he's gonna rip it off. When they come in like color coded,
Oh
walking in a
yeah.
straight line, and the music's playing, it's so funny. Or when
they say
Dona
like
Miriam's like peeking through the peephole, and he's like peeking right back at her. Sorry, I interrupted, but
it's fine. It could be in the that French movie he's doing.
could be.
But I love that they're talking like, you need to fix the situation. You're the man, and they say like your life left you for an uncircumcised man.
Right. Yeah, that's another spot where it comes up. And oh my God, the scenes of Malik trying to win her back are so funny because like he's so bad at it. Like he's so bad at showing affection. Like at a certain point he just sort of has to accept that like, yeah, she's not coming back. Like I loved her, but it's too late. I was too bad at showing it, and I drew her away. Like it's on her birthday, and he's like, "What? Just because it's your birthday doesn't mean you can't serve me, woman." Like he's talking like that to her. Like no wonder she's gonna leave you.
That ties into the whole like cultural assimilation thing with Sex Okra and Salt-N-Butter has, where it's basically all about like him he wants to go back to Molly. He just wants to be back home and be African, but he's stuck in France, so he kind of he has to convert somewhat, to a Western European lifestyle, and he is fighting it where his whole family is either okay with it or they have completely changed. And even like the aunt when she visits, she's like she just blends in totally fine because like
Everyone like has no trouble blending in and sort of either assimilating or just sort of accepting that some things are different, except him. Like he's the only one who has a hard time with this. Like his friend at the bar, who he's like, "Oh, I changed my name to Ludovic. Call me Ludovic now." Like he just keeps shaking his head at everyone sort of assimilating, but like by the end, I sort of feel like okay, maybe he's not going to assimilate to French culture, but like he's gonna assimilate to his family at least. You know, like he's gonna accept that, like, yeah, my wife's not coming back, and you know, I love my son. And like the younger kids, when they just keep playing video games, and you know, he's just like he feels so out of touch with his own family. It's also like it's sort of notable that he seems quite a bit older than the wife who leaves him.
And he has very young children.
Yeah, like he's probably like late 50s, early 60s, the character, and like, you know, he's got young kids. It's you know, you sort of understand like why it's hard for this guy, but at the same time, like you're not exactly empathetic. Like he's more like you pity him for most of the film, I guess, because he's just like he would be more empathetic if he wasn't such an ass, but it would also make the film not a comedy, you know what I mean? Like him kind of struggling with all this is where a lot of the humor comes from.
I love that his kids, they're actually his kids, are like they're just like modern children in every way. Like
Yeah,
they
they just play their Game Boys and like listen to music and
Well, one kid's not listening to music. He listens to like poetry for some reason.
right, well, yeah, that one part where the woman who starts living with them, the young woman, when she just lifts the headphones and you're not sure what to expect, and he's listening to this like poem, but you know, it's sort of like, oh yeah, you don't necessarily know what somebody's listening to. Like I have big headphones on and I listen to podcasts, like not heavy metal or anything. So, you know, but yeah, like it's, I don't know, it's such an endearing film actually. Like you care about all these characters, and then you sort of Malik, he's kind of the most miserable one, but you end up caring for him because like he just doesn't, like you get the sense that he really does love his family. It's just like he keeps kind of struggling with it, and he's sort of doing the best that he can, so like that kind of makes you care about him.
Like all the kids and the wife and everyone else dresses, in modern like Western European type clothes, but he will still wear traditional clothing, and like the whole house is decorated with like artifacts and pictures and designs that are from Mali. So, so like everything, his whole world is like trying to fight back against, like French culture.
Sure. I mean, and like the Madame Miriam character, I forget the actress's name, but I know she's in Amelie. But like they clearly have a thing going and she's flirting with him and like he likes her, but at the same time, the way he kind of closes himself off to her can actually be sort of hurtful. Like there's that scene where she's in her nightgown and she's got her cleavage out and he's saying like you think he's gonna ask her out or like, oh, like, you know, I have my kids, I don't have a wife, and like she's like waiting for him to you know, she's like half expecting him to say something really
Like
affectionate,
romantic or
and he's like,
something.
yeah, how about I pay you to come over and do some cooking and cleaning once in a while? And like, you know, right before the scene cuts again, like, you know, the way that A Screaming Man has like very sharp editing, like the scene cuts just when you see her eyes water up, and you can tell that like that really hurt her, you know. And later on, she wants nothing to do with him for a while, but
I feel like her being a white woman also plays into him like being kind of resistant.
yeah, like he wouldn't want to be seen with her in front of like the three wise men, or you know, so like when he invites her to the party near the end. You know, it feels like him, like that's his way of reaching out and trying to get past that.
And You don't really know her past. Like, he walks with a cane and she walks with a cane. So, like, there's this immediate connection. Like,
Does she
they
even need
have.
the, like, she has that crutch? Like, I was wondering if she even needs it, because, like, you don't see it later on, and I thought, like, she only kind of, like,
You
took
see
it
it?
down.
You see
Like,
it?
I don't, she obviously has it, so, like, maybe she, like, broke her foot at one point and, like, kept it or something, but, like, I was wondering if she was just, like, faking when she's saying, oh, can you look at my foot? But, yeah,
That's a really strange moment.
it's cute.
It's like the closest to like him being intimate with another woman you
Yeah,
see him get.
rubbing her feet. Oh my, like, it's kind of a sex comedy at some point. Like the opening scene when the wife's having sex with the guy in the other room, and the other nurse is just like screaming, like, "Oh, my stomach!" to try to cover for them. Like it's really funny.
Yeah, let's see. This kind of feels like vaguely like Ozu with like the whole like family and like about the culture and thing. And there are some shots that are very Ozu-esque where like like Ozu will like do a shot of like a hallway.
Yeah, we're like you have those shots where it's like framing through the door a lot of the time,
And
and
a screen man reminds me of Late Spring a little bit
okay.
with like the parent-child relationship and how the parent makes a decision that they regret, that they can't take back. Where at the end of Late Spring, Chichiru,
Right.
he's like cutting an apple or a pear or whatever, and he realizes, his daughter is married off and his life will never be the same again. And it's very similar to Adam letting his son's body drift away in the river, with like him realizing, well, this is a mistake I made and I can't take it back.
That's a good connection. I mean, it's tough to find something to compare a Screaming Man to. Like, these long scenes of driving on the motorbike and the kind of realist approach. I thought a little bit of My Friend Ivan Lapshin, the Alexei German film, where you also have like scenes with the driving with the sidecar, and it has this sort of tragic end, where it's done subtly, but you sort of realize that you're facing this huge tragedy. So like that's one thing I kind of thought of watching it, but I don't like it's a Screaming Man. Like I think I liked it even more than Darad. Like it really, the emotion of it hits so hard. Like it feels like you're being crushed by 20 tons of brick, emotionally speaking, at some points.
It's a really just like a brutal movie emotionally. Like it's like it feels like it's like an emotional horror movie to an extent.
Sure. I mean, like. I don't know, like, not the best comparison, but, like, the way that something like Breaking the Waves just kind of throws you through the ringer emotionally. It's a little bit like that. Like, it's not that long. Like, I think it's 1.5 hours exactly. And it's amazing just the kind of weight of emotion and range of experiences that you can fit into a film like that. Like, it feels very carefully plotted, again, carefully edited. Like, I think that's one of the strongest things about it. The performances are so subtle. I think, like, for me, the shot of the film, again, it's that close up on his face where it's just like the edges of the frame are tightening in on him, and it's this private internal sort of desperation. And this, it's a story about this one particular man's big failing, basically as a person, and the consequence to that and how hurtful it is, and to kind of do a film that's in some way about the Civil War, where you have like a civil war within a family. It's a father and a son kind of against each other, and you kind of feel the larger consequence of that. We're killing each other, we're just hurting each other. That sort of conclusion is part of what I took about the perspective towards the Civil War in Chad.
And cooking comes up. I know cooking is like a link between this and Sex Okra and Salted Butter,
Right.
where like there's a whole there's that the dinner scene between Abdel and Adam with the mom talking the whole time, and she knows something is up, but they will they just refuse to speak to each other until she gets up, and I asked him like, why did you take my job, more or less. And once she comes back, they remain silent. And I think that's when. And David earlier in the movie says like cooking is an act of love, and
Yes.
so like this during this moment that's supposed to be like family togetherness and about spending time with your family and appreciating each other's company. It's this very slow, like emotionally, gut-wrenching, dinner scene.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that also connects back to Darat, where you have the baking, making food. It's sort of an act of love. Like something very similar, I think, was said in Darat. And again, also like Sex, Ochre, and Salted Butter, the cooking plays a role in the film. So, like,
Yeah, because
when the
Malik
girl's making
won't.
the okra food, and the kids are like, one kid said, "Ah, this is gross," and the other one's like, "I like it," and she's like, "Oh, do you want more?" And he goes, "No."
That you get like a Judo Itami like food montage of her
oh yeah,
cooking, and
I
then
love that. Anytime you have like the close-ups on food in movies that looks delicious, like I love it. More films should have scenes with cooking. I watched somebody's video essay about the John Travolta Gotti movie.
Oh yeah.
And like they're going on about like all the reasons why it's terrible, and then they got to one reason that stuck out for me, and they're like there's no scenes with people eating or making food, and it's like they're comparing it to Goodfellas, where you have like all the scenes over like people talking over eating, and it's like showing these scenes in Gotti where they're just like they've got an empty table and John Travolta has like a glass of water, and they're like, what is this? And I don't know, it just sort of for some reason stuck out to me as kind of I don't know, like food, it's such an important part of our lives that films that might actually overlook that and look over the sort of social significance of food and the kind of things that go into food, like maybe it's missing something that's very essential, like the Sex, Ochre, and Salted Butter, sex and food, though, those are two sort of universal human things.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if it shows up in A Season in France, which I think there are a couple food sequences in that, and like the dad in A Season in France works in a fresh vegetable market.
Okay, like that's, I mean, that's significant, working in a fresh vegetable market.
Yeah, and then in Grease, I try to remember, but it's been a while since I've seen it. I kind of don't want to watch it again. I'd rather watch like I want other ones again.
Right. And I don't know if there's anything we didn't cover that you would like to, or.
I guess like the how like in Screen Man the military presence keeps getting bigger and bigger, or it
Yeah.
starts out it's just on the news, it's on like on the TV news and the radio, and like Adam will occasionally like sneak off at work just to listen to radio, but then it gets and you see like soldiers more often, you see like you hear helicopters in the distance, and then you hear gunfire, and then it reaches the point of at the hotel you see a bunch of UN soldiers. I think they're UN soldiers. They have like a blue hat, so I guess.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there are UN soldiers, and they were just kind of like relaxing at the hotel.
And you see like less. I'm not trying to make it about race, but you see less white people there who are just having fun. You see, it's like gets more empty and empty, and then it reaches a point of. I think that's like the sequence of like when he's going home at night and it's just completely dark
Yeah.
and like you hear like you see soldiers around everywhere and he goes down like this alleyway and it's pitch black except for the
It's
light.
actually scary when the soldiers stop him, like you get the sense like they could shoot him even if things don't go well, like it's that kind of a tense situation. So definitely, like at the beginning it's more like a hassle when he has to show his papers at these checkpoints and stuff like that, but yeah, it gets increased as the film goes along. The images that were on the TV, I'm get, like that was probably from a real news report, like they looked like real
I would think so.
dead bodies, that they were showing, and
I mean,
like,
Harun was a journalist
yeah.
for before he was a filmmaker, so like I'm sure he'd have connections of like how to like where to get the good stuff
Yeah,
from.
but it's also like those were also pretty shocking images. If you think like that's what's on your news all the time,
Yeah, when I say good stuff, I don't mean like it's. I mean like, you know, like what
No,
would be good for the movie.
yeah.
Yeah.
I know, I know. I mean, like, I don't know if you had a chance to watch that interview where he talks a little bit about
Oh,
when he was,
yeah.
yeah, like shooting Darat, you had a bunch of people killed.
On the actor played a team's 18th birthday.
Right. And I forget how many people he said died, but it was like
I think I won't say
100 or.
100 or 200. It was a shocking amount.
You know, like just to. And he talked a little bit about having that kind of hanging over the production of that and thinking about that going into A Screaming Man. You know, there's a somberness and there's a heaviness in the film that I think, like, you can't fake. Like, you can't be an outsider filmmaker coming in and sort of trying to instill that gravity to this sort of situation. Like, it just feels like it comes from such an authentic place.
Like it's a movie only he could have made.
Anyway, so thank you again. And
You're
if
welcome.
f folks want to find you on the internet, where can they look?
They can find my podcast at Podbean. That is Week Ahead, the Spike Lee podcast. It's the same feed as High and Low because I'm cheap and it's probably smarter to keep the same feed. We are. I don't know when this will come out. Maybe by that point we'll have the She Hate Me episode out
Okay.
because I wanted to get the one out of the way early, and Marcus Penn volunteered to be on that one. Thank
Right.
God, because I didn't want to talk about one.
The worst Spike Lee movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, if folks want to follow this show, it's at flixwise.com, at flixwise on Twitter. I'm at MovieCastler on Twitter. And until next time, listeners, take care.
Give me